If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret, searching for the sound. This is the Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
Before we get to today's show, I wanted to tell you all about the new SoundStream app. It is the new home for all things sound podcast, and now you're able to listen to the perfect blend of music you'd expect from us 24/7. Jam bands and more, much more. New episodes of the podcast arrive at least 3 times a week, and now you can listen to your favorite artists and bands all the time in a perfect music stream. Just hit the play button and away you go. You'll be boogieing in no time. You can make requests, offer shoutouts, and even let us know when your birthday is, all from the SoundStream app. Get the app at thesoundstream.com or in the Apple or Google Play Store. The show starts now.
The way any young man should. Sitting around the campfire, singing about the man, and wondering what I could do with a 6-string in my hand. Well, I was found in San Francisco, got lost in LA, dug into that desert soil and found another way. Had my share of heartache, my fill of joy, had my share of growing up and forgetting to be a boy. Are you sad or are you lonely or somewhere in between? A lonesome LA cowboy in the San Francisco scene. It's not I need to label, it's just I'd like to know what to look for when your subtle exhibition starts to show. So I got my wheels rolling and went looking for my place, northbound on the interstate to keep pace in the race. There's folks who wanna own me, folks who like my style, folks I know who wish I'd up and vanish for a while. Are you mad or strong and silent? I'd like to know what to look for when your subtle exhibition starts to show. Get on! There's a woman in the redwoods who says she sees me right, and I'll admit I've seen her in that settled kind of light. Barbecues on Sundays and football on TV, if it's all the same to you, just you be you and I'll be me. Are you an introvert or extrovert or somewhere? It's just I'd like to know what to look for when your subtle exhibition starts to show. If I play it upon your heartstrings, thrust my fist into the air, sang an affirmation and proclaimed I do declare. Would you look at me and label, say you need to know what to look for when my subtle exhibition starts to show. Would you look at me and label, or say you'd like to know what to look for when my subtle exhibition starts to show?
You've been listening to Subtle Exhibition from Alex Jordan's debut solo album, Subtle Exhibitionist. Alex Jordan has been involved in the music scene in the Bay Area for a few years now, and you've heard his work with Midnight North. Now, as he sets out on his own, he's released a very impressive solo record that needs to be heard. So we caught up with Alex to talk about the subtleties of being an exhibitionist and putting out a record. Our conversation started when I asked Alex what the impetus was for making this record and how things got started back in November of 2017.
Well, I'd been writing on and off. I had bands in high school and bands in college, and I wrote and fronted those and co-fronted with, you know, some other of my friends. But as time went on and I finished school, I was kind of like, okay, well, if I'm really going to do the music career thing, I'm going to do it. And so I focused mostly on playing. But I did write occasionally. And so when I hooked up with Midnight North in the very end of 2013, I had been doing some writing, but it really wasn't quite the direction that the band ended up going. So even though we played some of my tunes for a year or so, they didn't really stick with the repertoire. So I just had these tunes that I was sitting on and continued to write a few more. And so I made an effort to try. I had this idea. I was just going to get all of the people I knew and different guys I really liked playing with, and get together and try to make a semi-live record. That just absolutely did not happen, because, you know, trying to manage people's schedules is a nightmare. And so that was probably end of 2015, beginning of 2016, something like that. And I was just sort of like, I was discouraged and just, oh gosh, whatever. So, Midnight North had just finished making, a record, and I liked that process evolved, and I really liked where it had evolved too, but that wasn't where we did spent the majority of our time and effort making the record. So I kind of wanted to pick up on that. And that was with David Simon Baker at Allegiant Records, in San Anselmo. And I really liked the kind of things that Dave, I really liked his history, like what he'd done and who he'd worked with and the kind of sounds he'd got. And I heard a record by Greg Loicano that came out that was recorded at Allegiant. Songs of a Golden Dream, or Songs from a Golden Dream. I always forget if it's of or from, but
yeah.
Killer, absolutely killer record. Oh my God. And the playing on it, the drumming on it, the guitar playing on it, the tones on it. It was just a meaty record. And I just said, I contacted Dave and said, let's do that. And he said, well, that's here. And so I started rehearsing with Sean Nelson, who was playing drums on and off with Midnight North at the time before we hooked up with Nathan Graham. Sean and I did we really got along musically, because he also went to music school and did stuff like that. And we had a handful of rehearsals and got into it and went into the studio Thanksgiving weekend. And it really immediately was kind of the right thing. We were much more rehearsed. The plan was a lot more structured. And I had decided that if I was going to make it happen, I was going to have to do a lot more of the heavy lifting than I had intended. Which ended up being a personal and artistic challenge, just to force myself to play a lot of instruments, specifically all the guitar parts, because I'd been playing keyboard full time with Midnight North. So it was a different thing. Anyway, but that's how that came together.
So that's interesting that you mentioned that you had to do a lot of heavy lifting on your own. And I know that reading the release for the record, you do a lot of the playing on the record, right? I mean, you have Danny Eisenberg, who comes in and plays on keys on some of the songs. And you have Sean, who obviously plays drums, but a lot of it is you. And obviously you can't do the whole thing live. It's a matter of you. It's a matter of you putting down the drums and the bass tracks and then adding the layers, right? I mean,
So what would happen was the first tune on the album, Your Kingdom Comes with a View, that was me in one room, Owen McGinnis, who plays bass on that track, in the control room, and Sean in the drum room. And the three of us, we probably did five or so takes of it. And my guitar and my vocals were just there for reference. And so once we got a good drum take and a good bass take and together, once one that was good for both of them, we moved on from that. And I just layered on top of that. And there were other tracks where I would play the guitar part and there'd be no bass, and I would have to go back and and actually put the bass on. And Steve Adams plays bass on a couple tracks. Like I didn't prioritize myself on anything other than the guitar. That was the goal. You know, the guitar was a personal goal. But other instruments, if a certain player I knew was going to be the right fit, I tried to get them on there. And so Steve Adams is such a great kind of rootsy country player when he wants to be, especially, I mean, he worked with obviously Nikki Bloom and the Gramblers. He's super groovy with ALO, but, his work with Broke Down in Bakersfield, is that record actually is a lot of what got me into honky tonk and country music. And so, their live release they put out. And so having Steve play on a couple of the real country or more country tunes was really a no brainer. But Danny Eisenberg, I could have played Hammond on the first track, but I wanted what Danny was going to do. I wanted his kind of flamboyant style, right, as only he can deliver. And so that was a very conscious thing. And Dave Zirbel plays steel on the record. I don't play steel, and I owned a pedal steel at the time, but it would have just been terrible. And I wanted someone that was going to have a really classic, you know, kind of Burrito Brothers thing. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't really know that that's what I wanted. I just knew that that was the sound. Right. And I didn't know that, you know, who it was or where it hurt. I just knew this guy's going to do the right thing. So things like that were prioritized. But then I really did want to try to play as much. And then eventually, you know, I had a weekend available and booked on the calendar, but couldn't get a bass player. Okay, I'll just do it. And Dave really pushed me. The bass sessions were actually some of the longest ones for me, because it was a matter of getting it to be not just tight, but also right.
Right.
Which was a lot of fun. I played bass when I was much younger. And so I getting back into playing bass was really a good experience.
It's interesting to me that, you know, you went to school for vocal training and you were in choirs and such, and you have this enormous talent to play. Whether you play them well or not, you at least play them. You play bass, you play guitar, you play keys. You probably could play drums if somebody forced you into it. No,
if I had a kit to practice on.
But that speaks to probably your musicality and more just wanting to be a musician, right? I mean, is that something that you always knew you wanted to do growing up, that you wanted to be a musician in some way?
I've always known that music was going to be a part of my life. My father was a music teacher, and he was actually my music teacher when I was in high school. But it was before that even that I had settled into music, and he by no means forced me. It was just something I wanted to do that felt right. And I have memories of being a little kid and you know, singing along with the radio, or you know, just humming my own, making up my own melodies and things like that. And music's always just kind of been a part of me. I think at a certain point I learned one instrument, you know, the first instrument I learned, right? Which the earliest things I goofed around with were like harmonica, but the first instrument I really got into was the trumpet, and that lasted a couple of years, and then I picked up the tuba, and that lasted a couple of years, and then I wanted to play I really like the jazz trombone, so that's what I got into for most of middle school, high school. But by then I've navigated treble and bass clef, and was interested in other things. And so into my hands went the ukulele, into my hands went the bass guitar. And just, you know, once you start learning instruments, it gets addicting. And if your brain is wired to you know, decipher these, how to make music on these things, you just, you know, someone gives you an idle weekend, you just kind of do it.
As crazy as your musical background in terms of playing an instrument, so too is your taste in music. And that certainly comes through in this record. I mean, there are honky tonk songs, there are, you know, alt country songs or country songs, however you want to say it. You really do run the gamut. There's even a bluesier number that to me sounds like, you know, an Allman Brothers tune. California in My Eyes has a very feel to it, right? So I'm curious about the influences on you and what kind of music you were listening to growing up. Now, obviously you weren't listening, maybe you were, but I can't imagine you were listening to tuba music all the time, or
no.
or, horn music, but you were probably listening to music that influenced kind of your writing and what you wanted to produce in a record eventually. What were some of those bands that you were listening to in San Francisco?
Well, when I was growing up, either the classical station or the jazz station was on pretty much. And if those weren't on in the morning anyway, and in the afternoon and on weekends, a radio station called KFOG was on. And a lot of people, I'm surprised how many people outside of the Bay Area know KFOG. It was, you know, it was such a cool station because they were, this is before, you know, Sirius or iHeartRadio or any of that kind of stuff. I mean, they were a radio station. They didn't have a playlist they had to subscribe to. They just played what they wanted. And it was everything from local artists to classic rock hits. You know, that, I mean, the term classic rock was something that I was familiarized with because of them. And then they had what they called world-class rock, which was just this idea of things that were rock and roll and rock and roll affiliated. That was just good music, good writing, good, you know, it was substantive. And the DJs on there had great taste. They just were kind of great DJs, period. You know, their morning show was always really interesting. Yeah. I mean, I remember on 9/11, you know, you just woke up in the morning, you had Dave Morey and Peter Finch, the, you know, voices of KFOG, telling you about this thing. And that was the end of the time period in which the voice you heard in the morning could really change how you felt about something that was national news like that. But I think between KCSM, that was the local jazz station, you know, and KTFC, which is the classical station, and then KFOG, that really shaped a lot of what I was listening to. I was in wind bands and I was in jazz bands, and my grandfather had a big record collection and CD collection, and my father had a really big record and CD collection. And I remember it, by the time I was in middle school, I was just every afternoon picking a new CD and putting that and just listening to that. I've told people I used to go out in the backyard and dribble a little ball around the patio, kind of just to keep myself occupied, my hands occupied, so that I could listen to whatever it was. And I just went through alphabetically.
Wow.
And so, I just listened to a lot of things I probably wouldn't even remember having listened to. But
so the influence is enormous in terms of kind of what you grew up listening to, right? I mean, it was just all available. Right.
Yeah. It was just all available. I mean, I don't know what I gravitated to. I don't know when I started gravitating to specific things, but it was all there, just about anything.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's 2017 and you start this project and it takes you, well, 3 years, right? I mean, March would have been 3 years.
Yeah. So it would have been about 18 months of recording the records, recording the vocals rather, recording the instruments and vocals, another 6 months of mixing, and then another 3 months of trying to get it out.
It's interesting that you mentioned the vocals because you are trained as a vocalist, and because these are your songs, so you obviously want to emote them appropriately. One of the things that I find on the record is that the vocal performance is amazing. I mean, the diction and the phrasing and everything else. I mean, there are some lyrics that have a lot of words that you have to get through.
Right.
I'm impressed with the vocals probably as much, and you know, this, it's different for every record, but for me, the vocals are as good as the playing on the record. Is that something that you intended because of your training, or is it that just something that you're good at?
Well, I think at this point I just have high standards, and to be honest, Dave Simon Baker does too. He's a master editor, but only when he has to be, you know. And so his, you know, his intention with me on the record for most of the record was not to, you know, have to, you know, sit in a soup of takes and have to, you know, really piece something together, and which you know gets done now. That's a modern way to make a record, but in many ways he wanted me to have a take that if we had to live with every single note of that take, we could. And that was, he really pushed me there. And I remember just long days recording the vocals. And we were up at his place too. That's the only stuff we didn't do in San Anselmo. And so I had, there was like, you know, a little trailer that they have, it serves as like a little guest room. Out by, he's got these goats and these chickens. And I would just, after, you know, doing a song or two, just these relentless takes on a couple songs, you have to go and just lay down. So it was a lot. And I think we're both perfectionists. And I think that made a big difference. And I, you know, I mean, Dave's opinion was that I could do this. And so he really wanted me to get it. So we just didn't stop. And just like the instrument tones and everything else, we didn't stop until we had it.
Right. Well, it is from top to bottom, a great record. It's something that you could put on and really enjoy because, as I said, it is so multifaceted in terms of the sounds and the instrumentation and the genres. So it is great. Why don't we go through a few of the tracks, if you don't mind?
Sure.
Because I'd love to hear some of the stories around the record. The first song on the record, and you mentioned it already, was Your Kingdom Comes with a View. And it's an interesting story because it's about one of your father's former students, if I read this correctly.
Well, it's influenced by that.
Influenced,
yeah, his style. So there was a band, the guy's name is Kevin Gilbert, and there was a band in the early 90s called Toy Matinee. And they put out a record called Toy Matinee, and it was he has a certain snark to his writing style. And I wanted to kind of capture that. And that snark, you know, allows you to talk about different things than sort of my inherently, you know, a little bit, I don't know if I'm believable, but at least, you know, kind of vulnerable, you know, tenor
I'm,
you know, blessed and cursed with. And so having that, translating that into something that's a little more of a commentary was something. And he was involved in something called the Tuesday Night Music Club, which is what made Sheryl Crow's first record, just named after that experience, just a group of writers in LA. And so if you listen to the song All I Want to Do, and Strong Enough, those are songs that, you know, you can tell me whatever you want, but she did not write those. He did. If you listen to the other material he has written, those are 100% his style. So that kind of vulnerability mixed with snark. And then on top of that, I just wanted to tell the story. I started writing that one in early 2014, I think. And I was just reflecting, having that just moved back to San Francisco, on how harsh people were on Barry Bonds, and not just him, but just any hero. Just anytime someone achieves greatness, we all want to see them break the record, you know, be the cool thing. And then the moment anyone achieves that, we're like, okay, well, what's wrong with them? Why did they get to be special? Why are they special and I'm not? And so we just like, we can't just let someone be cool. We can't just let someone be good at something. We have to bring everybody down. And so that's just sort of my feelings on that.
I Know I'll Be Okay is the next song on the record. And it evokes, you know, memories for me, at least sonically, of country music, mm-hmm. Working Man's Dad, CSN. I think that's where the steel guitar comes in at some point. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Yeah, that's right. There's a pedal. That's the pedal steel's entrance on the record. That voice.
Yeah. And so, you know, speaking about vulnerability, here you are back in San Francisco after being in LA. Probably wondering what you're going to do with your life, right?
And, oh, yeah, yeah.
And you know, I guess, that it'll be okay, right? You know you'll be okay.
Yeah, I mean, I spent almost all of my money, everything I had, to get back to San Francisco, to leave LA, you know, coming at the time that the difference in expense, you know, between San Francisco and the rest of the world was heavy. And so I think I had somewhere between $0 and $60 by the time I arrived on my parents' doorstep in January of 2014. And that's all I had. And it was odd though, because it just didn't feel hopeless. It didn't feel like I wasn't leaving LA feeling like I had failed. I felt more like I had succeeded in a way, even though I had nothing left, and because I had opportunity that was that was a that was potential opportunity. It wasn't even a sure thing. And that became Midnight North, of course. But and that was a whole different thing, because I was just moving home, not, you know, and it just didn't feel like I had failed. And so I felt very hopeful. And in the recent months and weeks here, that tune has taken on a different feeling for me. Because I think that it is really easy to just open up your phone and or your computer and look at the news and just feel like, well, this is all just it, you know, this is it, yeah. Like, there's nothing left. And it's easy to feel that way. But I think at the same time, the moment we let that all get the better of us is the moment that we succumb to the negativity and succumb to that feeling of failure, as opposed to feeling of hopefulness.
I mentioned it already. California in my eyes. Mm-hmm. You're a California kid, whether you grew up in San Francisco or did schooling downstate in mm-hmm. at Long Beach. California is an important state for you and an important place mm-hmm. to be, obviously. Talk a bit about growing up in California as opposed to, I don't know, growing up in New York or middle America. What is there something
right.
tangible that you can feel about growing up in California?
Well, what's weird about California compared to a lot of other states, and the West states have a little bit more of this in common, but not quite as much, is that you can drive an hour and a half and be somewhere completely different. I love New York. New York is this amazing place. It is a trip to me that you can drive an hour outside of New York City and just, you know, be in Westchester County and just have this lush, thick foliage everywhere. And there's just life everywhere. There's life to the point that you're just dodging it on the freeway and it's, or the parkway, as you might say. And so it's really interesting, but the whole state is like that. There's really not a part of New York that is vastly different. You know, whereas in California, if I drive an hour north of where I am here, I end up in this sort of in wine country, and which is a different look than the suburbs of San Francisco. And if I drive 2 hours east, I end up in the foothills of the Sierras. If I drive 4 hours, I'm in Yosemite, and five, I'm in practically in Nevada at Mono Lake. And when I was living in Los Angeles, you could be in the coast with the palm trees and then drive inland and it just gets deserty real quick. And that's that, it's just different living in California. Things are more diverse, but also don't seem quite so spread out. Or rather they are spread out. And so it's just, you get used to that being the case. And so there's just so much here. And when I was living in Southern California, that was my introduction to the desert and to the sort of desolate beauty of these vast open skies and just endless terrain of these little small, you know, creosote bushes and stuff just stretching off towards the Joshua trees and all that kind of stuff. And it was just really, I fell in love with that instantly, just instantly. And to the point that right around the time I wrote that song, I got into those desert thunderstorms. About a year later, I spent most of my, in fact, the entire summer chasing the thunderstorms. So that tune and just that feeling of the Southwest, which of course extends in Nevada, Arizona, Utah, that kind of stuff. But that feeling of the Southwest, and it just feels like it drains towards California. And you end up back in, you know, on the West Coast. If you just follow the terrain, you end up there.
Till We Are Gone mm-hmm. is this samba in 3/4 time. It's got right. a Graceland vibe to it. For me, it has evokes pictures or thoughts of hippies dancing around. Like, it has a very happy feel to it. That this mm-hmm. is, you know, Till We Are Gone. We're just going to party, right? I mean, that's how I took it anyway.
Sure.
It's one of your earliest songs, I think, that you wrote for this record. And again,
sure, I don't,
again, it's Kevin Gilbert
right.
is sort of, it's a tribute to Kevin again, right?
Right. So this is back, what I was referencing, that song Strong Enough, the Sheryl Crow song. There's a thing, you know, we often describe something as being in 3/4 as musicians, but it really, it's in like, it's in 6 or 3/8 or something like that. And it's just, it's, you know, yet, and this is like one 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, more deliberate about it. And it is a different vibe. I borrowed that from Kevin Gilbert too. But lyrically, you can kind of run with it a lot of different directions. In some ways, it's sort of the acknowledgement of the fleeting nature of relationships, but maybe the fleeting nature of existence. You couldn't even make the argument that I wrote it for this record. I think you can more closely make the argument that I just wrote it, and it's there. It sat for years before I dusted it off and kind of polished it to make it work for this. But the Graceland thing, man, I really wanted to hit. I've really always loved that the bass playing on that record, and I tried so hard to find someone that would be able to do that, and I couldn't find anyone that was comfortable on fretless bass and got that. So I was over at my parents' house and just stole one of my dad's basses without telling him. That was a fretless jazz bass, and just tried my best at that. That took a lot of work. That was like a four-hour, five-hour, you know, marathon of me trying to get the bass to be right, because I had to practice it for a while and then go on from there. But I really wanted to get that Graceland dancey lilt feel where you just like kind of had to sit there and bob your head the whole tune. That was the goal. And Sean Nelson really knocked it out of the park on the whole record, but on that song, I told him I wanted a samba in 3/4, and he just about threw drumsticks at me, because him being a school trained guy, that doesn't make any sense,
right?
And so I went out and picked us up pizza, and by the time I came back, he'd worked out that groove, and I said, "That's perfect, dude." So that's what it became.
It's interesting that, you know, you wanted to have something with a Graceland vibe to it. I get the impression that To Be Whole is sort of the Simon and Garfunkel-y
right.
type song. I get the impression that Simon and Garfunkel, or at least Paul Simon, has had a significant influence on your writing and your playing. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think I probably have underestimated until more recently how much I like Paul Simon. Because it's not, I don't get in the car and just put on a Paul Simon record. But then again, any Paul Simon song that comes on, I'm like, oh, this is a good tune. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because he has that canon of music, and we all know the songs, and we don't think about them all the time. But mm-hmm. then you hear them on the radio, or you hear somebody cover them. There's a great cover by Green Sky Bluegrass of Gumboots, and you think, oh, yeah. What a great tune, right? And you think,
right.
Wow, that's Paul Simon. Or you think of, you know, just generally, you know, one of my favorite songs of all time is Slip, Slide, and Away, and you don't hear it often anymore, but it was like a B-side, or it wasn't necessarily his most popular song, but these are songs of that era that are, you can automatically understand why he's been so influential in people's career that have come up past.
Oh, absolutely.
Him.
Absolutely, and as someone who also has a little bit of a higher voice, it sort of serves me to listen to him a little bit. I have memories that now that we're talking about this, I have memories of as a kid of taking road trips. You know, probably they probably weren't all that long, but when you're, you know, five, it feels like it's forever. And the whole family could agree on Graceland. So I have memories of listening to that record as a kid in the car, just on the way to my grandparents' house in the mountains or something like that.
I'm going to screw up the pronunciation here, so I apologize
sure.
to all the Hawaiian people who are listening. It's Makuahine, I believe.
Makuahine.
Makuahine. Do you have Hawaiian roots, or is it just something that...
No.
No. Okay. The reason I ask...
I love Hawaiian music.
Yeah.
I love Hawaiian culture. I mean, they're these awesome, like, accepting, laid-back, you know, people that they're also intense in some way. I really dig slack key guitar. I think it's an amazing way of playing the guitar. And I'd been back and forth to Hawaii as a West Coaster, that's the vacation spot.
Yeah.
And my dad started coming back a number of years ago, back once I stopped getting taken on the family vacations. And he would be learning the slack key kind of guitar stuff, and he really got into it. And so I would hear it. I'd hear him playing it, and I'd hear artists that he would put on. And then finally I went more recently, and heard some Slack Key stuff live. And I had that melody, but hadn't done it as a Slack Key thing. I had just sort of done it as like a finger pick thing that wasn't quite fleshed out. And as soon as I heard open tuning kind of stuff live and saw these guys playing, I said, well, that's how that song is supposed to go. And so it may have been subliminally there, but that's where it worked out. And just other Hawaiian music too. Like, even when you talk about the steel guitar, that has Hawaiian roots too. So I love that stuff. It's awesome. Not just because it makes me feel nostalgic for Hawaii, but because it's incredible musicianship and incredible music and just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful playing.
Smile at Me is another track off the record. And we're getting towards the end of the record, but what I liked about Smile at Me is there comes a point where there is this really dense music thing happening. I mean, it's only a 4-piece band, but there's a lot going on in this one section. And I think I read that there's something like 32 tracks.
Give or take.
of different instrumentation going on in that section. I mean, is this something that you worked up? Is it something that you thought of ahead of time? Like, how do you and David Simon Baker come to this idea that you're going to fill the board? I mean, literally fill the board with sounds for part of the song.
Yeah. I certainly like progressive rock and, yeah. You know, things like Dark Side of the Moon, pretty much anything Pink Floyd, a lot of later prog stuff. The more metally prog stuff doesn't do it for me. But if you think about those classic sounds, there's a lot of big sound in there. And of course, I love the Beatles and everything. And so that section, I knew going into it, that I wanted it to kind of explode. So we started with just, you know, big drums right there, you know, big drum fill into a big heavy section. And of course I tracked on a grand piano, and that helps fill things out. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, then I go, well, it needs Hammond, you know, it's just like those big, like in Us and Them, you know, the B sections in Us and Them have this big, huge Hammond thing going on. And then what does it need after that? Okay. Well, it needs feedback guitar. Okay, great. You know what it needs? It needs a trombone, trombone sections. Okay, let's put four on there. You know, it's this four layers of me playing trombone on there. You know, okay, it needs these like bell things. And we tried to get the bells with the hitting the piano and you know, banging on mic stands and stuff. And we left all that on there. But then I went over to the band room at my old high school and recorded myself playing the orchestral chimes. You know, so now that's on there. And then, you know, and then, oh, you know what, it needs like a four vocal thing. And oh, what about, and so just, and you just, it just, and we just kept going until we were like, it doesn't need anything else, you know?
Yeah. So, we have no more instruments to put on this.
We can't think of anything else to put on. So there it is. And it's cool. The intention with that is that if you're sitting there listening to the whole record, you know, front to back, or at least the second side, because we did do, you know, the whole experience is tailored for vinyl, that is a point in the record where you've come far enough. It's the second to last track. You see, you've come this far. I tried to like lull you into a sense of calm with the Makuhine, the only instrumental. And then you hit this kind of jazz trio thing that turns into a 4-piece that turns into this huge section. I just wanted it to just feel like, for you to be so relaxed that you couldn't do anything other than listen. That you sort of, I wanted my experience of it to be immobilized by the amount of sound, and have to listen to it 15 times before you can hear everything. And that was the intention. And I like those big things. I really wanted to create something with that. It's not necessarily everybody's favorite track on the album, but it is the one I'm the most proud of in terms of what we created and the sonic journey of that.
I would imagine that live it has to become obviously something completely different because you're not
totally totally live. It's a little bit more of a rock ballad with a jam at the end, you know.
yeah. So that brings up an interesting point. Here we are in the middle of social distancing and quarantining and COVID-19 and being in lockdown or whatever, and putting out a record now and touring a record is incredibly difficult. So right. I'm curious about A, the timing of the record, and B, what's the plan? I mean, aside from just getting it out there, what is the plan for you to play the music on this record?
Well, the playing feels level, and if that just about no one's touring or playing music, so it's not like I'm not getting out there when I should. But the timing of the thing, it was done, it was ready, and the modern convention, the modern wisdom is less so about touring behind a record and more about having content, because content is valuable and is, you know, you have to produce it constantly. And knowing that there weren't going to be a lot of live shows, this was something that I had ready to go that I could spend several different opportunities talking to people about. So I think that's the sort of how to navigate the business, you know, one idea of how to potentially navigate the business right now. But live is obviously the goal. I love playing live. I'd like to play live again. I just did a live stream last night. And that's not the same thing because it's me by myself. I'm much more of an ensemble player. And so I'm just kind of keeping my eye out. I know that people have been booking things, but I know that by and large, people are afraid to announce anything, because the moment you announce it and sell tickets, if it has to get moved, that's a whole nother headache. And so everyone's just scared to commit to things. And so you have these major festivals that already sold a lot of tickets, you know, they're able to kind of just talk about, you know, oh, we're going to do it in October. Oh, we're going to do it next year. Oh, we're going to do it. You know, they can do that. They can play that game. But everyone else, the small venues and the artists and quite frankly, DJs and, you know, podcasters and things like that, we're all just sort of like wondering what's going to happen. And I don't know that I have answers so much as we all want it to happen again. I think in some way I would like it to be different. I would like, you know, the emphasis on things to be more about the music and more about the artists and the fans and less about the spectacle of things. You know, the small venue is really where music is made. The club is really where music is made. You know, we last crossed paths at CMAC. Yes. And killer venue. Really a great spot. It was a rainy as heck day. And a great lineup, but it was nonetheless a great experience. But here I am on stage, God, 40 feet from my bass player, and while we could, you know, really play with some gusto, achieving nuance at that level is not the easiest thing in the world, a near impossibility on a half hour sound check since we were the opener.
For sure.
And that to me is amazing, and that will continue. But that isn't where music is made. That isn't where artistry is made. That isn't where you forge relationships with fans and relationships with each other and relationships with venues. And I that has to survive. And the venues want it to survive. The artists want it to survive. And I'd say probably everyone who does what you do wants it to survive.
For sure.
You know, so, but it's a matter of whether the economics want it to survive, whether the people that control where the money goes in the world decide whether that's valuable to culture or not. And I think they will. I hope they will. Mm-hmm. But that will shape, you know, what the plan is with touring. That will shape what that looks like, because if it means that a venue can exist and we can open the doors and have 25 people somewhere we would normally have 100, then great, I'll take it. I'll take it, because I would love to play music for 25 people who are just really happy to be there. And I'd love to someday play music for, you know, any number of people, and we're going to get back to that. It's all going to exist again. But right now we really have to assess what we want this to look like when the dust settles, because we're among the last of the industries that are going to get back to normal. And sure. So this gives us the most time to decide what we want normal to be.
It's interesting that you mentioned CMAQ, because I hadn't been there in probably 20 years. And going back, it was way bigger and way more, like there was the second set of seating on top and everything else. And
right. For
me, it was way bigger than I had remembered it. I had remembered it as a smaller venue. Now, that's from a fan's perspective. Obviously, on right. Stage and being 40 feet away from your bass player is something totally different. But for me, it was one of the last remaining very intimate amphitheaters. And that's why I loved right. It. And that's when I heard you guys were playing, within 5 hours, we got in a car and came down. So to me, it's interesting that you say that from your perspective. And which brings us to Subtle Exhibition, the title of the record and the last track on the album, which is interesting. And we'll get to that too, is why you put that at the end. But it's interesting because in the notes, you say you wanted a rootsy rock vibe, which you have achieved, obviously. Mm-hmm. And it's as though you were seeing a band live at Terrapin, which mm-hmm. is for somebody, a San Francisco musician who is of a certain age, who grew up listening to a certain of music. I would imagine that playing at Terrapin is the pinnacle of all of that, right?
It's been pretty cool.
Right. Talk a bit about, before we get to Subtle Exhibition, talk a little bit about playing at Terrapin and kind of what that room has done for musicians like yourself or other musicians who are friends of yours, just having a venue like that to go to and right. Own your chops.
Well, it's sort of somewhere between potentially every local band's cavern club, and a lot like the folk and the jazz rooms of the village in New York. You know, it has this idea where people are coming through and playing in different combinations, and then also bands are playing weekly, and that, you know, things have changed as time has gone on, but that's how it was when I first got there. And the fascinating thing with that is, it would take you the better part of a year before you'd played with everybody that was in the rotation of the sort of group of musicians that were all involved. And of course, there'd be new people all the time, like myself. For those that haven't been there, there's three stages. At the time there were two. There was the ballroom stage, which, you know, holds about 400 people, and it's a pretty sizable stage. Plus there's the bar stage, which is in the bar part of the restaurant, and the throw from the stage to, you know, the fireplace, which is what you're looking at directly across from the stage, is only 20 feet, and so it's not like this big deep thing. And then even to the far reaches of the bar is only 50 feet or so, you know,
right. You're
not playing to a big crowd. And on top of that, you know, if Phil is playing up there with a what he calls his club rig, Phil's club rig is bigger than some people's stadium rig, you know, and so there ain't a lot of room. Once you put a drum kit and a full bass rig up there, there's not much room at all left on this little teeny stage. And, you make it work. You just get used to playing really tight, and it's not like you can't hear anybody. You know, you can hear everything really well, and of course it's the sound system's good because of where it is and who's, you know, behind it. And so it just allows you to have this experience of maybe there's 10 people watching and you're going to play whatever you're going to play that night, mostly covers, you know, but you do play originals, you know, people play plenty of originals there, and not exclusively Grateful Dead music by any means. And it just created this thing where we weren't trying to specifically entertain people. We were trying to create new experiences every time we were on stage, things that were as enjoyable for us as they might have been for the audience if they went off without a hitch. And I've done sets there where 80 to 90% of the set was improvised. And I've done sets there where we've played 40 tunes in 2 hours. It's been really interesting. And it's just an intimate vibe. You cannot be far from the stage. You cannot be, you know, you are never going to be able to not hear. You know, it's just, it doesn't reward loud playing. It only rewards, you know, modest playing. And so anyone that just refuses to turn down ends up sabotaging themselves. And so it just has an interesting, interesting thing. So playing there with a band every week with Midnight North was, you know, we could gauge our progress. And a lot of times we would stream the shows on Facebook, and I would get home that night and watch the stream back and go, oh God, that was terrible. Oh, that worked, you know, the stuff like that. And you do that every week, and you just, you can see what works and see, okay, we got four people that show up every week to see us play. Great. Okay. We got 10 people every week. Oh, nobody came back after last week. Well, what's going on? Oh, you know, Fish is at the Greek, you know, you know, stuff, all kinds of stuff like that. So you play for zero people, you play for 100 people, you know, they're shoulder to shoulder, they're dancing in the walkways, the waiters and waitresses are dodging these twirlers, you know, or there's no one dining, there's no one watching, you're playing for nobody, you know, everything. And it is, and it's just really interesting. It's sort of the last, it's the only place I know of, contemporarily, that is that. I've read about things like that, we've heard about things like that, but it's the only place I know of that currently exists like that. And I'm honestly, because of COVID, I can't even say currently.
Right. Yes. And I guess too, the amount of musicians that come through there, whether they're Bay Area people or people that come to check out Phil's place,
right,
too, must have been really exciting to be able to share the stage with your cohorts who are, you know, like Ross James, who's there and plays mm-hmm. there a lot, or when visitors come. I mean, that must be exciting too, right? I mean, it's just,
Trey and Bob and Phil have all played on that stage.
Yeah.
You know, but so too have me, you know,
yeah.
and people who've only played there once, and people, you know, this, any, all kinds of things. It's just a room, and you know, by and large, the shows are free because it's just a bar. And there's no cover to go in and walk in and to the bar and the restaurant. There's no cover to get dinner. Can't charge a cover to order dinner.
Yeah. So let's talk a bit about Settle Exhibition in terms of, we've got the vibe down. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We understand the vibe. I would imagine that this song was written later on, probably.
Yeah. Oddly enough, I titled the record, The Subtle Exhibitionist, as sort of a project title, kind of in the way that they title movies. But, you know, as a project before they have a title for the movie sometimes. And while I was working on that, I was driving across the country. I was delivering an organ to a buddy of mine who lived in Alabama, who bought one from me. And I don't need to get into why I had multiple Hammonds for sale, but I was driving across the country, and I was just staying in a hotel in Wichita Falls, Texas. And I was just sort of mulling that concept of the Subtle Exhibitionist over, and I started writing some things down. And then when I got to his place, he's a ranch in Alabama, when I got there, I ended up finishing the tune. And it started more as a folky tune. And then I was like, I don't need a folky tune, I need a rocker. And so I just kind of improvised that the groove, and Sean and I laid it down. And that was the first take that made the record, the first take of the thing. And I just had this idea of everybody's trying to put on a show. Everybody's trying to be perceived in a way that's that is visible and intentional, while at the same time trying to seem unintentional about it, trying to seem casual about it. And that was what a subtle exhibition meant to me, besides the just hilarity of the juxtaposition of the terms. But that's it. You have these A sections where someone is just not being subtle at all. They're telling things biographically, effectively, which is loosely based on some of my experiences. And then these B sections where that same person is asking someone else, you know, to interpret their own actions, which are none of which are subtle actions, you know, that really shouldn't need interpretation, but that's the world we live in, where we can't necessarily trust what's being presented because, appearances are so much. I heard it put earlier today that that perception matters more than intention, and I have to mull that over, because if perception measures more than intention, then that's a me thing. My perception matters more than your intention, and therefore that's just ego, and I'm not willing to acknowledge you. I'm only willing to acknowledge how I feel and how I think. And that's not going to help us. That's not going to help anybody. But right. That's the way the world has gone, especially when it comes to social media and everything really ties back to that culturally. And so anyway, but I just, you know, every time I think about that thing of a subtle exhibition, I sort of try to contemporize, you know, especially right now, it's kind of a good time to look at and how that's going. So it's fascinating. But that tune didn't, the world was not what it is now when I started writing that. And I started writing that late in the process. You know, I had one more session on the books to do basics. And that song was not on there. And I wrote it and we added it and it worked. And then we decided to close the record with it.
It's interesting that you've chosen that to close the record.
Right.
Intentional. You obviously it's there, but it kind of bookends the whole experience, right? With the title of the record and the end of the record.
Yeah, I wanted the title track last, you know, because I thought it was, one, I thought it was just stupid and funny. And maybe my sense of humor is no good, but artistically, I thought that, you know, I thought it was more subtle to have the title, more of a subtle exhibition, if you will, to put the title track at the very end.
Right.
And on top of that, the first tune, Your Kingdom Comes with a View, has this feeling of a band starting up a night at Terrapin. That was the intention. And the subtle exhibition, I wanted it to feel like a band ending the night at Terrapin. And even to the point where the ending is just plain sloppy. The song ends, and not everyone ends at the same time. And the guitar, you know, I say not everyone. It's me and Sean, but
all the different instruments. Yeah.
Well, and to be honest on that tune, I won't get into naming names, but I was specifically trying to emulate players I knew on every performance. I wanted to play them because that's what we were doing by that point. But I wanted to be like, well, this is what so-and-so would do. So I'm going to imitate so-and-so. And, not in an insulting way, more in an appreciate them kind of a way. But that was it. I wanted to feel a little bit like different players and less like five copies of myself.
Yeah. It's an amazing record. It's a great achievement. It took a long time, obviously, to get it down. And like I said off the top, you have your whole life to write your first record. Are you always writing? I mean, in this time of COVID, there's not a lot to do but probably play and write and fool around. Is that something that you're doing or not so much?
Yeah, you know, while I'm recording, I tend to write. And so while I was making the record, I wrote a lot. And I've written a little bit since. And I've written a little bit during COVID. But you know what? It's not just COVID, but everything that's going on with regard to social justice and economic inequality and people's varying politicized opinions about what just amounts to a health issue. It's really discouraging, and it's to the point that it's hard to write.
Yeah.
It's hard to put things together, and I don't feel like I can possibly capture enough of what I'm feeling and the frustration and the difficulty, because there's so much. I almost have to collect my thoughts more, on it and give it time. And I honestly feel like I can't finish some things until I see some resolution with these various things. And there's no resolution right now, you know? So I don't, it's sort of like telling the story that I don't know the end to. I'm not ready to tell it. And so I have been writing, I have been compiling, and I actually am beginning to make plans to start, hopefully this fall, start the next record. Which is just that's how it goes. You put out a record and everyone's talking about, oh, this is great, this great new thing. And you're like, yeah, I finished that 2 years ago, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that's always how it goes, I'm told. But I'm stoked. I'm stoked on being able to finally bring it out and show it to people like you, people that I know that really are going to give it a genuine listen, as well as just, let it be out there in the wild and see who picks it up and see what they think of it. It's been really, really fun to get all kinds of feedback, even to the point, there was a review I read that I don't know if they I don't think they disliked it, but I don't know if they liked it. And that was cool too. to see an opinion about something I've created is neat,
Yeah. Well, I for one think it's a great record. I appreciate the vocals, as I said to you. I appreciate all of the music that's on the record. I think it's a great achievement for somebody who's been working on it for so long. And I wish you the best, man. I'm really psyched for you and psyched for what the next phase of all of this is. So congratulations on the record and good luck, man.
Hey, thank you so much. Thank you. It really means a lot.
You can tell, I think, from our discussion that Alex is very serious about his art and the craft that went into making Settle Exhibitionist. From what we can gather, this is just the first of more records and a solo career that is off to an exciting fresh start. To keep up with Alex, check out alexjordanjams.com and find him on social media. Before we leave you, have a listen to Smile at Me off of Settle Exhibitionist.
Passed me by. Remember the way that we cry. And you look so angry when you smile at me. Spring didn't burn. Though winter did grieve, and summer sees its end, in autumn's turning of leaves, stay a while, don't regret what's come to pass. It will not last. It's strange how much promise when two young eyes meet. It's comic, it's tragic. It will end in defeat. You think I learned my lesson from screaming and pounding your door? And when I'm called to question, you'll ask. Passed me by.
Remember the way that we cry, and you look so angry when you smile at me.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. For more, visit thesoundpodcast.com.